Hey folks, before you listen to this week's episode of Worst Foot Forward with our guest Tom Toll, all about the world's worst messengers, a big thank you to our Patreon supporter MB Saturn. Thank you for supporting the show, and thank you for suggesting this week's topic. MB is a Patreoner who donates above the minimum level of £5 a month, which qualified them to suggest a topic for the show, and they suggested, and I quote, "World's worst messenger or mail carrier. I feel with every marathon, there's got to be something opposite." And, well, this episode is full of quite a lot of opposites. So we hope you enjoyed the episode you requested. Sorry it took us about 6 months to make it. We were trying to nail down our guest, and Tom, as a comedian who is also a mail carrier, seemed the perfect person. So we just tried to calibrate dates, and we finally got there. If you want to be more like MB Saturn, head to patreon.com/worstfootforward. Drop us a few quid. £5 minimum allows you to suggest a topic of your choice, like MB did. And, well, hey, listen, let's be shameless. It's Christmas. It's a time of giving. And if you're someone who enjoys the show for free usually, maybe make it a little Christmas gift to Ben and I to drop us a few quid, a one-off payment. You can do that on Patreon. A little donation to say thank you for all the episodes we produced. If that is something you feel able to do, it would mean an awful lot to us to help keep the lights on at Worst Foot Towers. What else have we got coming up? Tom's episode is our last episode before Christmas. On Christmas Day itself, we'll have an episode dropping, and that will be our Best of the Year episode, our annual roundup of our favourite moments from the past 12 months. And as always, those of you who follow us on social media, who listen to us on Christmas Day itself, we expect, nay, demand, your photos of you listening to us wherever it may be, whether it's out in the fields on your farm, as I think we've had in the past, or whether it's digesting your festive bird of choice after a slap-up meal. Ben and I love getting to see where our listeners listen to us. Maybe you're listening to us in somewhere exciting, interesting, Bolivia, South Africa, Palau, Antarctica, wherever it is. Christmas Day is the day to show us your Worst Foot Forward colours. Best of episode on Christmas Day, as I said, we'll have a third foot before the end of the year, and we've already recorded our first two episodes of the new year. We've got an episode all about the world's worst industry with Stephen Healer, an old school friend of Ben's, who is a former British diplomat, who gives us a really brilliant educational talk about the arms trade and why the arms industry is terrible. Spoiler alert, it is terrible. And also we've recorded an episode with the excellent Ken Cheng, comedian, professional poker player, gamer, familiar to any of you who might watch No Rolls Barred, the brilliant board game channel. And Ken joined us to talk about the world's worst bet, which Ben and I messaged each other after we finished recording and said it was one of our favourite episodes in a long, long time. So some crackers coming up in 2024. And onwards and upwards we'll go. Who knows what else the rest of the year will have in store. As ever, if you feel able to support us on Patreon, you can. If not, give us a shout out on social media. Make it your good deed for the festive season. Follow us on at Worst Foot on pretty much everywhere you can find social media accounts. And follow us individually as well. I'm at Baz McStay, Ben is at Vanderlaugh. And thank you to those of you who've been joining us on Instagram. We've been posting a lot of Instagram reels in the last little while. Special thank you again to Nell, our social media guru, for cutting those together. And it seems a lot of you like them. We did one recently about pranks. We talked about the Berners Street hoax, which some of you might remember from our worst prank episode. You can head to our Instagram and see that reel. And holy smokes, it got 60-odd thousand views out of the blue. So if you're a new listener off the back of that, welcome. We greatly appreciate you. And if you haven't caught those reels, have a look. We just love sharing those stories. And they're a great watch. Try to keep them to about a minute or so. Share them among your friends. It's a lovely way of growing the podcast. That's about enough. You know how podcasts work. You know how social media works. Don't have to tell you how to suck eggs. Instead, you can sit back, relax, and enjoy this episode with Tom Toll, all about the world's worst messenger.
Welcome, pals, to Worst Foot Forward, the podcast that delivers the best of the worst. I'm Ben Vanderveld, and this week you find me licking the back of a picture of the Queen's head. Just showing my respects a year on. Sadly missed, Lizzie, too. Sadly missed. This time of year is, of course, the perfect time for the swiftly compiled missive. And this week I'll be helping my children write to Santa Claus. Now, my son's efforts are balancing between psychological warfare, daring Santa not to exist, while also hoping that he is, but also, if he doesn't, let letting him know that he'll come and find him anyway. But if he does, then he will absolutely take Rudolph hostage until he gets what he wants. I'm sure we can all agree that is an excellent tactic to get the Xbox that he doesn't know that he wants. My daughter has just drawn a picture of a crocodile. For myself, as is family tradition, I have just written a formal letter to my wife asking leave to remain on the premises for another year. And with me is the Jester, my Pat, the Angelica Houston to my Jack Nicholson, and the Kevin Costner to my massive flop. It's Barry McStay.
Sorry, just as you started interrupting me, a fly started bugging me, which feels like quite postmanly to be attacked by some animal as I'm in the process of carrying out my job.
Yes, it does.
Yeah, I love you. I used to love writing letters to Santa. Very satisfying. I know there's you can email Santa and all of these things now. It's not the same of writing Santa Claus North Pole and dropping that into a post box.
No, it's not. I never wrote to Santa because Jewish. Used to write cease and desist letters to the Greek authorities. And anyone who knows about the story of Hanukkah will understand what an excellent joke that is.
Very good. I think Santa's probably the most written to
fictional person,
character. Yeah. I believe Sherlock Holmes is up there as well. I think 221B Baker Street gets a lot of letters. And given that the location of on 221B Baker Street is like a Sherlock Holmes like gift shop and museum, I imagine there's just some intern whose job it is to open them and send like a copy and paste response saying the great detective is on the case. Bear with us for further news.
I think that'd be a great response to letters to Santa.
Yeah.
I'm already having to learn the protocol around Santa Claus because obviously I didn't grow up with one. Mm. My latest mistake was when my son asked why the second Santa that he met doesn't look like the first Santa, to which my wife explained, well, Santa has a collection of helpers because he can't be everywhere, to which the obvious response was, but I thought Santa was magic, to which I interjected, no, he has lots of body doubles like Colonel Gaddafi, which...
he regenerates every time you see him, like Doctor Who.
I was literally explaining regeneration to my son this morning, and I literally used you as an example. I said Doctor Who is like a magic alien, and instead of dying, he stays himself but looks different. It's like, imagine if I died and I looked like Uncle Barry, but I was Uncle Barry. And he was like, no, but you'd be Uncle Barry. And I was like, this is some really deep philosophy that you are not old enough to understand yet.
Quick spot quiz. Which direction does the Queen's head face on the stamp?
Down, so it looks like she's given the letter head. No?
No. We might test our former postal worker guest on this. A guest this week is a comedian, writer and actor from the southeast London town of Bexley Heath, not that far from me, as it happens, which is famed as the childhood home of Kate Bush, back when she was but a mere Kate Seedling. His first Edinburgh Festival show in 2010 was called On the Scrap Heap, about a six-year relationship breaking apart, which must have been tough, a breakup and then doing a month in Edinburgh. Some of his other shows include Mediocre Boy, Help Us Tom Toll, You're Our Only Hope, and before that, Prequel, which presumably told the story of the period leading up to the events of Help Us Tom Toll, You're Our Only Hope, but with fewer practical effects, more boring trade negotiation details, and Jar Jar Binks. He has toured the country with the likes of Rob Brydon and is also highly dependable as an adaptive performer, hosting everything from album launches for host rock bands to benefit nights for the Socialist Worker Party, although... being the Socialist Worker Party, they doubtless then insisted that those benefits be spread equally among the other underfunded political parties. So in many ways, you could describe him as a contributor to the BNP. He is an Amused Moose Best Comedy Show finalist and has been described as charmingly entertaining by The Scotsman, very funny by Fringe Review, and on this podcast by me. It's Tom Toll.
What an introduction. Thank you so much.
That's what you've done.
Yeah, I forgot the Socialist Workers part. I'm not a socialist. It was just a paid gig back in the day.
So you've approached that like a capitalist.
Oh, God, yeah. I drove to Sheffield for £30, I think. I think it was Joe Wells that booked me because he was in my car. He was knocking about with those lot back in those days.
Friend of the show.
I remember it was pre-Thatcher death because I remember they had a stall that was selling Thatcher Death Day merchandise.
Like they were taking a sweepstake.
Yeah, pretty much. They were like, you know, you could get your Thatcher flag when she died. your T-shirt for when she died. They didn't like her. And I think that was back in the day where I just would go, oh, I'll just say whatever I want. And I was hosting the gig, and I'm pretty sure I made some ironic pro-Thatcher remarks. But to be fair, they took it in good spirit. They knew I was having a laugh.
That's good.
I was going to say that's very out of character for members of the Socialist Worker Party to yes. understand things on more than one level.
Well, I think this is the 2011. I think people in general knew when you were joking a lot more back then. When I start, you know,
that is yeah. It's harder now, isn't it?
It is harder. It is harder because you can't say anything these days. No, you can just.
just should you. But more importantly, do you know which direction the Queen's head faced on the stamp?
I don't. I really don't. It's one of the things that I'd have seen it every day.
It's either right or left, isn't it?
Yeah, we can rule out up and down, definitely.
Yeah, or a straight forward down the lens.
that would be great.
Has Charles got a stamp? I've not seen Charles.
There are some. Yeah, they're starting to emerge.
I've not seen that yet.
Yeah, the monarch's head faces left on the stamps, but they alternate on the coins. So the Queen's father faced left, the Queen faces right, and Charles will face left again.
Oh.
I've always thought of, because in Ireland, we have, you know, robins and various different things on stamps.
Is that your queen?
Our queen. our queen is a small garden bird. I've always thought of the idea of, like, it being the same person all the time. On sort of stamps and coins, to be quite weird, a bit samey.
Yeah. I mean, she was around for a long time, weren't she?
Yeah,
she did really well, bless her.
Do you think towards the end she'd like look longingly back at some of the stamps and go, "God, I looked good 10 years ago when I for this portrait."
Do you think she ever came across money? She probably didn't, did she? Not in that way. Like,
look, I look hot on the £10 note.
Yeah, Philip, have a look. She would never see a note. She would never see coins.
A friend of mine got his portrait drawn recently. He was an actor and he was in a play, and somebody took a sitting with him while he was in the character. And he's just posted the image of the drawing on Instagram a couple of days ago, and he said, "Is it weird for me to want to buy this myself and have it in my own house?" And in the Queen's case, the Queen is carrying her face around, like, in her purse. It's everywhere. You can't go anywhere without seeing her face. Charles is going to have to catch up, obviously, but when you're the monarch and your face is just everywhere, you must be like, "God, at least in my house will be the one place I won't have my face."
I wonder whether the Queen ever got imposter syndrome.
Who would she look at to get that? Like Beyonce or something?
Yeah. The one thing I've not done in one's life is played the pyramid stage at Glastonbury.
No, but it's true. Like who would she get imposter syndrome? Who would be the next? It probably would be someone talented, no? Like in her head, she must go, "Well, I've only literally got this because I was born into this. I've not done anything towards this. We all work hard and we still got it." Do you know what I mean? We also get so for someone who doesn't really work hard, unless all royals when they're brought up as kids are just told, "Don't be self-aware," because if you're self-aware, it's a downward spiral from that point.
I think certainly Prince Andrew listened very carefully to that instruction.
Oh, geez.
we've learned that you're not terribly good at observing your work environment. What are you even worse at? What are you the worst at in the world, Tom?
Oh, worst at. So I'm rubbish at sort of life admin, paperwork. I'm just no good. I'll see something. I'll see an email. I'll know I have to deal with it and I'll put it off. Whereas I watch my wife will be on the phone to somebody and she'll be making notes as she's doing it. And I'm like, that's what I need to do. And then she'll then take those notes and apply herself to those notes. But with me, I very much will look at something and go, right, I need to deal with that. And then put it away. And then it will be in my brain going, you'll need to deal with that. So it's not like I've forgotten it. I'm fully aware of it. I'm just not doing it.
It's just filed in your abstract filing cabinet in your head. Also, is your wife... I'd like to think that your wife is always taking notes no matter who she's on the phone to. So even if she's like on the phone to her mum or her aunties or like a cold caller, just like she's constantly building up evidence to use against people.
She's just very good. She just knows, like, she... not on family, but she also take away from that. And she's very good at, as soon as she gets an email that's from the school, she'll email it to me, so we're both aware of things. And then she'll occasionally go, oh yeah, because there's that thing next Friday. And I'll be like, I know nothing about that. She was like, I did email you. And as soon as she says that, I'm like, she's definitely emailed me, because she, as soon as she gets, as soon as it hits her inbox, she emails it over. Because she gets the parent mail, I deal with the reading stuff, because you have to log everything they read, and I'm in charge of that.
Yes.
And I'm in charge of Stagecoach, which is a school she goes to, drama school she goes to on the weekends. So I'm in charge of that. She's in charge of, so the minute she says, I've emailed you about it, I know it's game over. I know that's an email I've ignored. I've seen an email coming from her and I've gone, yep, and I've ignored it.
You are continuing the pattern of which I am a part of, ragamuffin comedians with superbly organized wives who are basically Excel spreadsheets and a dress.
We're getting away with it. We're getting away with it.
This week, we are going to talk about the world's worst messengers. And Barry, you're going to go first.
Yeah. I read about stamps, first of all. And in the early days of the Postal Service, letters in the UK certainly were normally paid for by the person receiving the letter, not by the sender. So a recipient could, you know, if they didn't have the money, go, I don't want the letter, and refuse delivery.
Great.
People would be able to commit fraud quite easily. They'd write coded information on the cover of the letter, and the recipient would sort of look at it without opening it and then give it back and say they didn't want it, having received the information that they needed. Individual letters needed to be logged, and, you know, postal rates are very complex depending on the distance and the number of sheets and things like that. And so Rowland Hill was an individual who helped spearhead the postal reforms in the year 1840. Apparently, there's a story, probably untrue, that he noticed a young woman who was too poor to claim a letter that her fiancé had sent. And so he posited the idea of stamps. And the first stamp, the penny black, was launched. And he decided that he was going to make it cheaper for people. The price of sending a letter of two pages covering 100 miles could cost 18 pence. That's like one and sixpence, which is like a huge amount of money for the time. Okay, from 1840, that's just going to cost one penny. And increased trade and prosperity. More people sent more letters and postcards and Christmas cards. All of that. It sort of created a boom in stationery and other areas as well, because suddenly the postal service became accessible to all. But it wasn't the only reform introduced in 1840. There was a thing called Mulready stationery, which I really like.
What called what stationery?
Mulready. It's a surname.
Okay.
William Mulready was an artist at the time, and he was commissioned to illustrate these sheets. They were postal stationery letter sheets and envelopes. Very beautiful. They had like a Britannia at the centre of it with a shield, and there was a line, and there were various representations of different continents and countries, and people reading their mail in the bottom corners and sort of extolling the virtues of Britain and the postal service and things like that. And it appeared on the face of the sheet that you buy. So you buy the sheet of paper from the post office, you'd write your letter on it and you'd fold it, and it would be that the folded letter would have this thing. So it was like nearly an envelope unto itself. And basically, it was a way of franking your letter. You bought this thing, so you were kind of prepaying your letter by buying a Mulready sheet of paper with this lovely design on the front of it. He expected it to be really popular. And people went, oh, no, but the stamps are really cheap. and they're much easier. And I can just I have my own paper, so I don't need to buy a really fancy paper. 6 days after the Mulready stationery went on sale, Hill, who was heading these reforms, wrote in his journal, I fear we shall have to substitute some other stamp for that design, Mulready. The public have shown their disregard and even distaste for beauty. they were expensive and they were unnecessary and they were considered a folly. So within like 2 years, they were withdrawn from sale, and just stamps were the accepted method of paying for your post.
What you're telling me about here is the male version of Betamax.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. It lost the fight with the stamps VHS. Yeah. Did you read about the famous Athenian, the messenger?
From Marathon? No, I didn't.
Yeah, Pheidippides was his name apparently, and everyone knows the story that he apparently ran from the Battle of Marathon to deliver news that the Athenians had won and against the Persians, and he ran about 25 miles, which is the distance from the battlefield of Marathon to the Acropolis, and burst in and said, we've won, rejoice, and then dropped dead from exhaustion. But I didn't realise that there's a couple of sort of little extra bits to that story, is that Pheidippides wasn't just an athlete, he wasn't a citizen athlete, he wasn't a soldier, he was specifically trained as a hemerodromos, who was a day-long runner, was what they'd be known as. They were delivering lots of things and during the course of battle, and they would train, basically do ultra marathons over mountains and rocky terrain, for going sleep. They had extra special diets where they would eat fruit like figs, which I guess would keep you running. And he didn't just run the 25 miles from the Battle of Marathon. He had to first run from Athens to Sparta to get Spartan troops to help the Athenians to beat the Persians, and then back to Athens. So he probably ran about 150 miles.
Give him a horse, lads. Come on, yes, give him a horse. Right? Jesus.
I read a bit about people who were famous messengers, postal workers, delivery men. Walt Disney, when he was just 16, in 1918, he began working as a postal carrier in Chicago. And he was rejected for the job because he was too young. And apparently he went home, put on a disguise and makeup to appear older, and came back and got the job.
Love it.
It's like a Simpsons sketch.
Yes, yeah. Or like the Evil Queen does in Snow White. And he even worked he worked two different shifts. He'd work as a letter carrier during the day and then a route collector at night. And he had form for this. He left the job to go to Europe working for the Red Cross as an ambulance driver during the war, just in the aftermath of the war. And again, he lied about his age to get the job. And then he came home a while after that, and he took his first art job and went on from there. William McKinley, the American president, was a mail clerk in Portland, Ohio, helping to pay off his family debts. And Abe Lincoln, when he was 24 years old, he became the postmaster in New Salem, Illinois. He was known for personally delivering mail to people's houses when they failed to pick it up at the post office.
God, so I imagine Abe Lincoln was a big guy. Not like tall, stringy guy.
Yeah, he'd probably reach out of his office window and deliver them. but yeah, the whole Honest Abe thing, really, it's very obvious from this. He was helping people delivering their post when they couldn't come and pick it up. But when the office closed, apparently, there was a remaining cash balance of $16 at the end of the day. And he took it with him after he closed up the shop and held on to it, didn't touch a cent of it until a postal agent came to collect the balance on behalf of the postal service.
We didn't really talk.
What a dweeb.
What a massive dweeb. We didn't really talk about it at the start, but... Tom, you were/still are a postie?
Yes, yeah. To back up my claim of who the worst messenger is, there is a very funny sketch about it, and it was on the Russ Abbott show. when I used to go to my granddad's house, he had three tapes, three VHSs. One of them was the Russ Abbott show. One of them was Lady and the Tramp, and another was a Lauren Hardy tape. And so I used to watch them in rotation. The problem is, Russ Abbott had so many shows. I was just Googling Russ Abbott show. I put in the name of the sketch that I was looking for. Nothing on YouTube, just full episodes. Just wow. Reams and reams of full episodes. But yes, no, I've worked in Broccoli. I've worked in Bromley for the... Royal Mail.
What sort of a postie were you? Would you say you're an honest postie, or if there was a package that rattled with the sound of unpacked cash, would you be like, I'm going to keep that for myself?
Honestly, it wasn't worth it. Like, it wouldn't be worth stealing things. I have, as a postie back in the day, I came across a large amount of money that was just on the floor, and I picked that up, and that was about 200 quid. But that hadn't fallen out of any packages that I'd had, Your Honour. But no,
I think the terms within which that could have been prosecuted have probably expired anyway.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. The difference between posting back in the day and posting now is just packets. You know, you guys were talking about letters to Santa. People don't send much letters anymore. You still get your fair amount of post, but most of it is things like the NHS, sending out letters where... Really, they should send out emails, to be honest.
Yeah.
I think
it's more parcels rather than letters now, isn't it?
Even though Royal Mail is now a private company, I feel like there's a certain level of pride and standards. Me and my wife were talking yesterday about black cab drivers and whether they've got to do the knowledge still now that sat-navs exist. And I feel like the difference between a postal worker and, I don't know, someone who works for Amazon Prime is that a postal worker is able to correctly put a letter through your letterbox that is the right size.
You'd be surprised, Amazon... Ben.
Well, and also, I don't know, if you're in your postal van, you perhaps stay in a parking space rather than try and drive your Amazon Prime van over as many driveways as possible whilst also blocking the road and threatening to knock over several children on their tricycles at the same time.
Did you see that footage of that guy, the Amazon's parked on the... He's parked on the pavement. So the guy comes past on his bike and he's like, you shouldn't be parked on the pavement. The bike's like, well, you shouldn't be riding your bike on the pavement. And the guy then cycles back to confront him, completely loses his balance and almost goes over his handlebars. And it's just one of them perfect little sort of bits where you just think, just right away, if you're in an art, like, just like you're both in the wrong, but now you've made yourself look like an absolute tit by trying to confront this guy. And to be honest, yeah, you shouldn't be parked on the street. But at the same time, you're literally just giving a pass and you go, oh, so I have sympathy for those guys, especially as during the pandemic, I was as the delivery driver as well. And sometimes when you know you've got 10 flights of stairs to carry up 10 crates, the closer you can park, the better. But I fully sympathize with people that are trying to get past. But sometimes, guys, chill the fuck out. We're only going to be 10 minutes max. Come on.
I'm glad that I've given you right of reply.
Oh. I have such homeowner's guilt about living in a building which doesn't have a lift in it.
Oh, how many flights? How many flights are you talking?
Two story. We're on the second floor.
And that's not too bad. We can do that.
When you can hear someone who's got a heavy like bag with them and they're in like it's raining and they're in the heavy gear and all of that, I have to go down a half flight or two just to like try.
So you don't have letterboxes in the foyer?
No. If it's a big enough parcel and they have to come up, I do. Feel like, oh, yeah. It's the least I can do. Keeping us.
You're an absolute saint.
Thank you. The lesson here is I'm a better person than anyone else on this podcast.
Definitely.
Who else? Harry S. Truman was the official postmaster of Grandview, Missouri, but he only held it in name only as a title. He used the position to give a job to a widow, Ella Hall, and she did the daily duties and he gave her his $530 annual salary as well.
Right. Well, who was she to him?
Just a friend, I think. Yeah. Just a, you know.
I mean, I've got friends. But I wouldn't give them my salary.
Yeah, you know what, Tom? You've opened my eyes. What I thought was a generous act by American President Harry S. Truman was an act of nepotism towards a friend of his.
Yeah. I just think that back then, if you were to say, I'm just giving this woman this load of money, no reason other than the goodness of my heart, you'd be like, well, that's clearly not true.
It was like, I'm too busy bombing Japan. Let me pass this off to Ella Hall.
Hang on. He can't even claim he's too busy bombing Japan because nuclear bombs famously are quick. They free up your time.
Yeah, Harry Truman, lazy postman. That's where the image comes from.
I just question the relationship between him and this woman. That's all I'm saying. American presidents have been known to be whiter than white, haven't they?
Yes, that's very true, by and large.
So I'm calling into question all of them.
Let me try American Nobel Prize winners instead then. William Faulkner, one of the great novelists, he was also he hated being a postmaster. He was a postmaster at the University of Mississippi, and most of the time he would spend playing cards, writing poems, or drinking. He'd close the post office whenever he liked and open it wherever he felt like showing up. And when he was in the office, he would just sit there and write in his office on his own. He would generally have an attitude when customers came in of, you're interrupting my actual work. What the hell do you want?
Oh, brilliant.
That's the dream job.
That's what life used to be like, didn't it? You used to just be able to just be absolutely rubbish at your job. Yes. Like really rubbish at your job. There was no appraisals. He never had an appraisal, did he, that guy, William Faulkner? There was no one going, listen, you know, he was in complete autonomy of that place. There was no one coming in and going, you know, but you would accept it, wouldn't you, as well, as a member of the public? You wouldn't go on the Google review. You know, you would just have to say, oh, the postmaster there, he's a bit grumpy, so get there earlier because he normally closes before lunch. So get there, you know, but he doesn't open at 8. He opens about 10. There's a two-hour window where you need to get your stuff in. Otherwise, yeah. But you just accept it. That's what I liked. You know, there was no customer's always right. No.
Yeah. The customer is always annoying.
No. The customer gets in the way.
I could run a perfectly good post office if it wasn't for all these people trying to post things. That's very much his attitude.
Absolutely.
He did there were complaints against Faulkner, unsurprisingly enough, in 1924, and Faulkner agreed to resign, but wrote a resignation letter, which contains one of the great lines in resignation letters. "As long as I live under the capitalistic system, I expect to have my life influenced by the demands of moneyed people. But I will be damned if I propose to be at the beck and call of every itinerant scoundrel who has 2 cents to invest in a postage stamp. That, sir, is my resignation."
Bang.
Bang. And he spent 5 afternoons working on that resignation letter.
Yeah. Hilariously enough, in 1987, the United States Postal Service released a 22-cent stamp commemorating William Faulkner.
Of course it did.
Worth mentioning that the red post box, the iconic red post box in Britain, was introduced by Anthony Trollope, a British novelist himself. There are over 115,000 of them in the UK today, apparently. Also, I like the fact that Sean Ryder of the Happy Mondays, the Manchester band, was himself the son of a postman, and he did a 5-year stint delivering letters after he left school. His dad got him a job with the Royal Mail, and... there's some great stories that he's told about this. When he worked in Little Hulton, it was the region where the New Order bassist Peter Hook's mum resided, and Sean Ryder claimed he would steal postcards from Peter Hook to his parents. He also would, admittedly, ran scams, pocketed bank cards. He said he would take acid while doing his rounds, and apparently got sacked one day when he took it, met a local dog that tried to bite him, and he was so angry he picked the dog up, bit it, and threw it over a fence.
Oh, God.
Right. I'll level with you. If I had a job that involved regularly putting my hand near mouth-shaped holes, acid would not be my drug of choice.
Yes!
There's no dog there, was there?
No.
Yeah. He's bit a trash can and threw that over.
I was going to say child. He's thrown a child over a fence.
But I'm going to go for my world's worst messenger via a roundabout way of talking about shooting the messenger.
Oh, nice.
So that sentiment is expressed in Antigone, the Sophocles play, around 440 BC. There's a line translates as, "For no man delights in the bearer of bad news." You also get sort of a similar reference to it in Lives by Plutarch. He writes, now he's writing about Lucullus, the first century Roman statesman, and Tigranes, the king of Armenia. He says, "The first messenger that gave notice of Lucullus's coming was so far from pleasing Tigranes that he had his head cut off for his pains, and no man dared to bring further information. Without any intelligence at all, Tigranes sat while war was already blazing around him, giving ear only to those who flattered him." So Tigranes only wanted yes men around and didn't want people telling him the truth about what was happening. And in Antony and Cleopatra by Shakespeare, of course, Shakespeare muscles in on the act. Cleopatra threatens to treat the messenger's eyes as balls when told that Antony has married another, eliciting the response, "Gracious madam, I that do bring the news made not the match." But the worst incident of shooting the messenger, and indeed my candidate for the world's worst messenger, comes from this story involving Genghis Khan. By the year 1218... Genghis Khan had taken control of much of the eastern portion of what was known as the Silk Road, and his territory was now bounded by that of the Khorasmian Empire, which was a big chunk of Central Asia and Persia and Afghanistan. And they decided to make contact with the Shah of that empire. And having only...
Which empire was that, Barry?
That is the Khorasmian Empire.
Good, thank you.
It begins with the letters KHW. So they made contact. He wanted to open trade relations, but having heard reports of how vicious the Mongols could be, the Khoraz Shah thought this was a ploy to invade his land. So Genghis sent a bunch of emissaries to the Shah. They had lots of merchants and then a single Mongol apparently at their head to emphasize the fact they wanted to open trade negotiations. And the Shah, in turn... had one of his governors accused the group of spying, seized their goods, and arrested the party. So Genghis, in an uncharacteristic act of diplomacy, Genghis decided to send 3 envoys, giving him a chance to disclaim any knowledge of what this governor had done and hand over the Mongols and the merchants back to Genghis Khan. And the Shah executed the lead envoy, and then had the Mongol merchant party all put to death as well. Very much messenger plus all of the additional people shot by the Shah of the Khwarazmian Empire. Genghis Khan acted in a much more Genghis Khan way by retaliating with an invasion of a size of about 150,000 men.
There you go. That's the Genghis we know and love.
Cross the river. Yeah. He sent a group of his generals crossing a river in 1219, sacking the cities of Samarkand, Bukhara, Otrar, and many others, and took the capital city of Urgench, and the Shah fled and sought refuge on the coast of the Caspian Sea. But not content with that, after the Shah had died, nonetheless, Genghis's generals did a four-year lap of the Caspian Sea, conquering all the land around that as well, and made their first contact with the Europeans, which led to, about 40, 50 years later, the Golden Horde making their visit to the mainland Europe. So a single case of this Shah of the Khwarazmian Empire executing some messages from Genghis Khan led to hundreds and thousands of deaths down the line at the hands of the Mongol hordes. So that messenger who had his head chopped off is my suggestion of the world's worst messenger for what came after.
Tom, what have you got for us?
We all know, we all aware of the phrase, the charge of the Light Brigade.
Yes, Crimean War.
Crimean War. 113 deaths and I think 143 injuries. Mm. And it came down to miscommunication. So it was a British cavalry unit.
they had actually said into the Valley of Life 600, but they got confused about where they should be going.
Basically, they were attacking Russian forces. It was Crimean War, I think it's 1854, I think. Mm-hmm. And
thereabouts. Sounds about right.
But they were meant to attack another area. They were meant to go sort of around. And this in the Russ Abbott sketch, the aforementioned Russ Abbott sketch, the messenger goes back and forth between the two camps. And every time he gets there, the captain offers him a drink. So he keeps getting, so by the end, he's so pissed. And they're like, right, man, where do we go? He goes, go down the middle. And then the sketch ends with him having another drink. And you just listen, because I think immediately, as soon as they went down the middle of the Valley of Death, the captain was shot straight away, died. I think within 1 minute of the charge. And then subsequently, they were meant to go around the side. They went down the middle. And immediately were met with hundreds and hundreds of Russian guns.
I mean, it's a time in history when the British military were crying out for Pep Guardiola to just get a hold of their tactics.
Yeah, just go around the side. The I think the worst thing is knowing that they planned to go around the side, but the message got relayed to go straight down the middle. And,
yeah, so for non-British listeners, the Light Brigade was a light cavalry who decided to charge on horseback towards a Russian artillery battery.
And they did
also,
it.
Also, while we're at it, for non-British listeners, who is Russ Abbott, gentlemen?
He was a Chester comedian. He had a show on primetime television from 1980 to 1996, which is why I can't find this sketch, because he had 16 years at the top.
That is astonishing.
Mad, isn't
he?
He
is a British light entertainment titan, and we just don't talk about it anymore.
Ever. You know, it's like he's done something wrong. Like, he was huge.
Yeah, that's the mad thing. He hasn't done anything wrong. He's one of the few members of British light entertainment from that era who appear completely untainted by any dramas.
He was probably friends with them, sure. But he...
Okay, yeah.
You know, but he... I don't think he's done anything wrong, but... Yeah, I've not seen anything of Russ Abbott for many, many a year.
Surely he's got to appear on Richard Herring's Leicester Square Theatre podcast soon.
Yeah.
It's only a matter of time.
You'd like to think that, because in the pre-internet days, we're talking Morecambe and Wise, 30 million people at Christmas. You know, if you were on TV in those times, man, you were so mega famous, weren't you?
Yeah,
because there was four channels, five channels. You know, it was. Oh, Russ. But you showed.
Sorry, you're overcome with
I'm. You know what? What I just thought. No, you know what I just thought. I just thought of Russ Abbott walking down the street and no one giving a shit, and that made me quite sad. That made me quite sad.
I've just read about the dude who delivered the instructions. He was called Louis Nolan.
Oh, Louis.
No, Ludwig Nolan. And it says on the entry on Wikipedia to do with the charge of the Light Brigade that responsibility for the miscommunication has remained controversial as the order was vague and Captain Louis Nolan, who delivered the written orders with some verbal interpretation...
Just
not a phrase you want to hear, is it?
You got to be clear. You got to be clear. If it's a military, if it's a military assault, you got to get that bang on, I think.
Yeah. Apparently, this guy was also killed in the first minute of the action. He was dispatched by Raglan, who was leading the British forces, to send a message to Lucan, who was head of the Light Brigade. Lord Raglan wishes the cavalry to advance rapidly to the front and try to prevent the enemy carrying away the guns. Troop of horse artillery may accompany. French cavalry is on your left. Immediate. And then apparently, as Nolan was riding, Raglan shouted, to tell Lord Lucan the cavalry is to attack immediately. He kept giving, like, sort of some more specific and some less specific orders. And when Lucan was asked what guns were referred to in the letter, Nolan is said to have sort of gestured vaguely with his arm. Then there was a bit of a debate about where they should be going, and Cardigan claimed that Lucan had ordered him to attack without quarter given, despite pointing out the Russian artillery. Lucan said he'd claimed that Cardigan had been told to retire from the battle. It sounds like such a mess. Yeah, Nolan had said they have to join the fight, and so they off they went. The famous poem, Charge the Light Brigade by Tennyson, was written only 6 weeks later. I didn't realise it was quite so.
I suppose nowadays it would just be a tweet sent an hour after the event. You know what I mean? Like, you know.
Yeah, he wrote it based on two articles published in the Times. So it's not like, you know, not a live action report on the field.
No, but I like that thought. Poems that could have been a tweet.
Yes, yeah. One of the articles apparently said, the British soldier will do his duty even to certain death and is not paralysed by the feeling that he's the victim of some hideous blunder.
That's not a good thing.
No, it is. It does, you know, 70 years before, 60, 70 years beforehand, bode poorly for World War One, doesn't it?
Yeah. It's basically
when you're going, they've definitely made a mistake, but in we go, I guess.
Subservient, true, but also subservient to the end, isn't it? Is what
you're saying. Yeah. There's not many things that bade. Mm. There's not many things that bade well for World War One there, were there?
No.
Yes. Oh, I think this will serve us well in 4 years of attritional warfare.
I suppose actually you could probably go back to poem. There was a boom in poetry. You know.
Yeah.
Yes.
It was working class men getting their feelings out, I suppose, on the page.
Are you suggesting that imperialism and the build up to World War One is actually a conspiracy by big poetry?
Well, I'm not saying it's not. You know, it's do soldiers on the front line, like, you know, going back to, you know, sending a tweet, will they now have phones? Do soldiers on the front lines have phones?
Surely not. That'd be a security risk, wouldn't it?
Yeah. Oh, I imagine they must do.
Yeah, but they won't be able to sort of text back home. Why do you know? Maybe they have specific lines that they're allowed to go through. If you're a soldier on the front line and you're listening to this, could you WhatsApp us?
Yeah.
And let us know how it's going.
Yeah, I do want to interject here with something that about World War One poetry, especially that people overlook, is that a lot of the war poets, the famous war poets, were gay. Wilfred Owen.
Yeah, Wilfred Owen was gay.
Siegfried Sassoon, David Cuthbert Thomas.
I'm glad you backed that with people who were poets, rather than that just being a childish insult. Like, oh, sir, World War One poets are gay, sir. Like, you know.
Yes, yes. Yeah, I mean, Robert Graves, Charles Sorley, Ivor Gurney, a lot of sort of the less well-known ones, but people who had been well-known in their time. I always find it very interesting, particularly in British culture, how, like, you know, the World War One holds a very strong place in the popular imagination as a sort of a lost youth. And the sort of the machismo and the bravery of the boys in it. And a lot of their sort of memorialising is done by people who would have had, you know, romantic and emotional attachments to the men who were dying around them as well. So it's...
Yeah,
it sort of adds an extra layer to it, which isn't really taught very much. So
Well done. You've brought poignancy to a comedy fight. Yeah. Thank you, Barry.
Hey, you're very welcome. The other thing I like about the poetry to do with the Light Brigade is that the last of the Light Brigade was a sequel written to it by Rudyard Kipling. 36 years on, Kipling wrote a follow-up to it.
No way.
Kipling getting involved.
Yeah. Because he has to. apparently this was about a visit of the last 20 survivors of the Light Brigade to visit Tennyson. They were sort of reproaching for not writing a sequel, for Tennyson not writing a sequel about the way England had treated its old soldiers. So it was about sort of the veterans not being looked after.
Oh my God, so this sounds a lot like The Last Jedi, where someone's got reprimanded for not doing the sequel right.
Yeah.
Just no pleasing some people, is there?
Yeah. Have you ever, the thing I'm always curious about is, have you ever opened the door, or had someone open the door when delivering Tom to, you know, an odd sight? Like the classic is someone opening, answering the door naked or something like that. Like,
I've never had the Pat Mustard.
Yes.
I had a guy really have a go at me because he's had heart surgery and I was in a bad mood. And he went, I wish you'd wait, mate. I've had heart surgery. And I just went, how the fuck am I supposed to know that? And I could feel the words leave my lips, but I just was like, you know what? I don't know that. Like what? Why would you say to somebody, oh, I wish you'd calm down because I've had heart surgery, so I'm not going to get to the door. If I was to then walk away and take your package, you would be annoyed.
Yes.
But I've rung the bell twice because I can hear movement within the house. So I want to make sure that you heard the... And I just went, how the fuck am I supposed to know that? And I just walked away and I just remember thinking, might get in trouble there. But I didn't, because I think he was the type of person that actually probably needed to be told that.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
If I was the boss and I'd heard that, I'd just go, yeah, it's not really my problem. Yeah, fair enough. I'm sorry you had a heart problem, but I didn't damage your heart to the point that you needed that. Like, I'm literally trying to just deliver you a parcel. So that's something that really sticks out in my mind, just because of the sheer shock I had from my own reaction to it.
Yeah,
I was like, oh, wow, I must have been having a bad day to just be like, oh, you know, you fucking, you know, how the fuck am I?
I love that you're dealing with, you're dishing out heckle put downs.
I think it probably was that, yeah, because I was a comedian at the time, but yeah, so I was ready to just put him down and, you know, but yeah, I was also, I used to deliver to a guy called Gabriel, who's a classical composer.
Mm.
So I used to have chats with him. Lovely guy. Still friends with him on Facebook, I think. And he had this big, he was a bald head, big curly moustache. We used to always have chats. And I said, I'm going to the Edinburgh Fringe Festival and stuff like that. And then it was the third day in at the Edinburgh Fringe Festival. I walked out and he was out in the audience and you couldn't miss him. So in this respect, it's quite weird seeing someone outside of the context you're used to seeing them.
Yes.
You know,
because
normally it's a little quick chat. I'd have a chat with him at his door. He'd always have parcels delivered. He'd always have records delivered because of his job. Mm. And then, yeah, to suddenly then be at my area and then him be there, that was quite something. But I've had a few people that have come to see me live after being their postman.
That's nice.
Yeah, it's changed now. It used to have such a real intimacy with your customers that you'd see every day, especially those that had deliveries. Because there was another guy called Doug who was he owned a record shop, so he would always have records delivered. So I'd have loads of chats with him. And stuff like that. And I remember opening the door to him opening the door and saying, oh, I'm not going to be living here. And basically telling me that him and his girlfriend had just split up.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And so I felt like I was the first person he saw. So,
oh, no.
Yeah. But we had enough of a relationship that I, you know, was able to sort of talk to him. And you know, because I really liked his job. He used to go to like record fairs all around the world.
Mm.
I think I'm friends with him on Facebook as well, actually. So, yeah.
It's probably a breach of GDPR or something now, all of this, isn't it?
Yeah, probably. But, like, there's that level of intimacy you'd have with... So I never saw the naked ladies, but I saw the soul of men.
Oh.
Oh, my God. You've turned from a postman into the gatherer of souls. To begin with, I want to talk to you about a man who was a perfectly adequate postman, a Frenchman called Ferdinand Chaval, but he was a creator of remarkable things. He lived in France in the mid-19th century, and One day in 1879, he was delivering the mail when he tripped over a rock, and he picked it up and he was fascinated by its strange shape. And this apparently inspired him to create a huge palace complex. This is despite him having no knowledge of architecture or masonry. And over the 34 years, he collected and transported tons of rocks to this site, and he built a palace complex that was 25 meters long and sort of 8 to 10 meters high. And he even said he wished to be buried in the palace, but his request was denied. His neighbors, as he was making it, would just criticize him and mock him. And this is all the while he was building it himself, he would just collect stones along the route of his job and then take them back home and use them to complete the building. And it's a mad building because it's a real mixture of styles. It's got Chinese, Algerian and Northern European styles, and it looks sort of like one big castle grotto. When the French authorities forbade him from being buried inside the palace, he then spent the next decade of his life constructing a vault in the local cemetery, which he is eventually buried in well into his 80s. And inscribed on the palace walls is the message, "I'm not a builder. I have never handled a mason's trowel. I was not a sculptor. The chisel was unknown to me, not to mention architecture, a field of which I remained totally ignorant. Everything you can see, passerby, is the work of one peasant who, out of a dream, created the queen of the world."
What's the place called?
The Ideal Palace, Le Palais Ideal, and it's in Hauterive in France. Look it up. It's absolutely remarkable.
Yeah, having a little look at it now. Oh, yes. That's very pretty.
Oh, yeah.
Postman Cheval's Ideal Palace. You know what? I thought the punchline to this was going to be this guy who'd never done masonry and made this by himself, and even on his gravestone has the fact that I wasn't an architect, had built a palace all by himself, and it was shit. But it actually looks great.
Yeah, I'm afraid no punchline to that one. Not much of a punchline to the next one either, to be honest. But I want to tell you about a Norwegian American postman now. Now you'll know that the unofficial motto of the United States Postal Service is what? Do we know this, chaps? It's the really famous one.
Oh, it's the by through sleet and snow, that by day and night, that thing.
That's the one. Neither snow nor rain nor heat nor gloom of night stays these couriers from the swift completion of their appointed rounds. And I'm going to tell you about John Snowshoe Thompson.
Snowshoe?
Snowshoe, yeah. Oh yeah.
Unfortunate birth defect.
Yeah. But it made him unbeatable at squash.
That's a Channel 4 documentary waiting to be made. The man with tennis rackets on his feet.
Yeah. Right after the man for a bum for a face.
Yeah.
He was born in Norway in 1827. 10 years later, moved to the United States and ended up buying a ranch in California. And rather than panning for gold, you know, as was very common around there, he became a postman, but pretty much the most underappreciated postman of all time. Yeah. In that area, they had tough winters, and you had fairly mountainous land, and delivering the mail over these mountains was nearly impossible in the winter. This is 20 years before the first trains, and many of these passes were deadly on foot. Now, previous carriers had taken anywhere between 16 and 60 days to make this 90-mile journey. But when the call was put out for help, he came to the rescue using his dad's old snowshoes, which were basically skis. And so he would make these successful runs in 2 to 3 days, carrying 60 to 80 pounds of mail. And he made these trips twice a month for the next 20 years.
Jesus.
Which wow. is pretty incredible. He did this unarmed, rarely stopped for food or shelter, and he's thought to have rescued at least 7 stranded or hurt travellers. And all throughout this time, he was promised proper compensation by the authorities. Because here's the thing. He never signed a formal contract with the US Postal Service. And he naively thought, if I do my best by my local community, I'll get what's coming to me. And what was coming to him was not a single cent or dime.
Oh.
He said, if I do my job and get the mail to people, Uncle Sam will pay me. And Uncle Sam did not.
Nothing. We're talking like, or
literally diddly squat. Didn't get a single cent. All he's got is a statue.
So for 20 years, he just kept thinking the check would be in the mail, but his mail wasn't getting delivered.
No, ironically, they were like, yeah, it was a different lazier postman who was meant to be delivering that mail.
Oh, that's
heartbreaking, isn't it?
Ben, that's made me really sad.
Yeah, oh, I'm really sorry. Well, don't worry, because my suggestion's definitely going to cheer you up, because in 1913, the United States Postal Service raised their parcel weight limit from £4 to £11. What did people start sending by post because of this?
Babies.
Correct.
Oh, no way.
Wow.
Yes way.
Is that why the storks went out of business?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Basically, wow. it was in many places cheaper and easier to send them this way than via train.
No. Because did you have to buy a full ticket for if you had a child?
Yeah,
with you on
the
train?
Either a full ticket or... It was in places where the rail hadn't got to, so particularly in very rural areas, and only, I must say, with deeply trusted postal officers and postal workers.
Mm-hmm.
So the first recorded
not ones who are going to be kicking the parcels around the delivery room.
No. You wouldn't trust every with it, would you? Jesus Christ.
Is it just that he got confused about the term delivering?
Yeah, it must
I need you to
that.
Deliver this baby. What you need is a midwife. Well, we've got a postman.
Yeah. I should say, by the way, I just because this article mentions the phrase going postal. Have you heard this phrase before?
It's, only from the Terry Pratchett novel.
Is it Bukowski going postal? Has he got a book called?
He might do, no. So it's in 1986, it's that new, there were a series of incidents where United States Postal Service workers shot and killed managers, fellow workers, cops, and members of the public. In fact, between 1970 and 1997, more than 40 people were killed by then or current employees in at least 20 incidents. Now, wow. I'll level with you. I don't know whether that is above or below the national American average for workplace shootings. But
it's still prominent, I suppose.
It is still pretty prominent. And there are loads of examples of it. It's real. And going postal is in various different... places you mentioned going postal, the cracking Terry Pratchett novel.
It was called Post Office, and it is a autobiography.
The Bukowski book, yeah.
Yeah, it's about his years working at the United States Postal Service.
But it's a really common part of a language. Like Barry mentioned, the Pratchett novel. It's referenced in such cinematic greats as Naked Gun 33 1/3, Clueless, and Jumanji.
Imagine if those were the videos that your granddad had that you played on a loop constantly up, Tom.
Yes, Tom would only be a postman.
Yeah.
Imagine that. Imagine going in one day and having to deliver a bait. Like, that would really annoy me.
In the bag? Yeah. Do you put it in the bag? Do you put it on a set? Do you have like a papoose that you carry it around in?
You'd put it in that, but then it would be in with the other mail. And if it's sick or pisses shits, it's, you know, you then got to just explain what's happened to the other people. You know,
at least the post, the other letters are absorbent. So, you know, if you're sticking the baby in a post bag for the mail.
Exactly.
Yeah. Oh, what? Oh, God, this letter must have taken ages to deliver because it's sepia tinted. That is not sepia. The first baby, which was sent, was in Glen Est, Ohio, where postman Vernon O. Little was tasked with taking him just a mile up the road, and his parents had insured him for $50. But the distances kept growing. There was a two-year-old who was shipped from Oklahoma to Kansas, presumably via whirlwind. And the winner, 6-year-old Edna Neff, was sent 720 miles from Florida to Virginia. What I loved about it is that sometimes what they would do is they would people would just put their kid on a train, and instead of buying them a ticket, they would just give them a book of stamps, or even allegedly put the stamps on their forehead.
Nice.
It was very much not legal, and the Postmaster General, a chap called Frank Harris Hitchcock, basically showed parents the T's and C's that said only certain living creatures, mostly insects, qualified as harmless live animals and therefore could be handled by the post. And I love the fact that children are not considered harmless live animals.
I mean, Like, imagine putting your kid on, like, for 720 miles. It's not like they can text you when they get there and be like, oh, I'm here. Like, you would just go and go, well, I hope they get there. Like, there's no way of knowing.
It's astonishing. I'm trying to conceive of chucking my 5.5-year-old on a train and thinking how he'd get on. And listen, he'd come away a brilliant harmonica player.
Yeah.
That is the best I can hope for.
Yes.
So my old man used to holiday in Ireland every year, and he had family in Belfast, family in Southern Ireland, Clare. And he'd go, yeah. So what I'd do is I'd start the summer 3 weeks in Belfast and then 3 weeks in Clare. So I'd have my 3 weeks in Belfast and then I'd hitchhike down to Clare. And I was like, wait, what? And he was like 14, 13 at this time. And I was like, what a world where you would be able to do that. Just go, yeah. So to get from Northern Ireland to Southern Ireland, I would hitchhike down. I was like, that's insane. Can you imagine doing that now? That's like that. The world was such a different place in the 70s and 60s, wasn't it?
Yes, it was.
In so many ways.
In so many ways. I'm sorry. I have nothing to add to that other than, yes, no, it's just mental.
It's just a mental state of affairs where you just go, you did what? Like, oh, my God. Like, yeah. And the fact that like his mum and dad were like fine with it, but yeah.
That's the thing. Maybe our parents and grandparents were just made of sterner stuff. You chuck them out the window and be like, and now survive. And they'd be like, well, I will.
Yeah.
Imagine if it was still happening and we got those Amazon drones delivering babies.
Yes.
Oh, just a baby descending from the sky slowly.
Yeah,
onto what,
through a skylight. Either that or just banging the baby up against your window. Delivery, delivery. No, thanks. Send it, stick it under the mat next door.
Yeah.
So our nominees for the World's Worst Messenger are Barrys of the Faceless Messenger, who angered Genghis Khan, thus unleashed the Mongol fury on Europe for generations. Tom's nominee of the Drunken Postman at the centre of Tennyson's poem The Charge of the Light Brigade. And mine, the postman from Ohio, who thought it was okay to deliver babies, but not like that. So I'm going to reduce my postal midwife, and I mean, really, gentlemen, this is sort of an open shut case because it's pure body count. Like, neither of yours did their job particularly well, but Barry beats you, Tom, by a factor of several hundred, if not thousand.
Absolutely, no, it's our old friend Genghis. You know,
yeah. When it comes to body counts, both in and out of the bedroom, he is the historical goat, which is also his favourite dish.
Hey.
Before, thank you for greeting that with a goat noise as well. Before we go, it's time for the best news of the week, and we go to Tokyo, where Britain has won a gold medal, gentlemen. Do you know what competition we've won a gold medal in?
Oh.
Being most British while in Japan.
No.
What?
It's actually for being most Japanese while in Japan in many ways.
Sumo?
Not sumo. What was your guess, Barry?
I was going to be something like origami or something like that.
No, we have won the inaugural litter picking World Cup.
Oh.
Yeah, participants from 21 countries gathered in Tokyo to see who could pick up the most litter within 90 minutes.
I was going
to
say, Tokyo's already clean. They should have that in like a country that needs it.
Yeah, because instead of it, just you have to go out and find it, then it's sort of like a game of hide and seek all of a sudden.
Yeah.
Yes.
The World Cup is called, it's called Spogomi, or Sport Gomi Hiroi in long, which literally is sport picking up trash. There is even an anime film about it, Spogomi World Cup Exhibition Match Arc, and it's a coming-of-age story set in a near future world where Spogomi is a sport as popular as soccer. I recommend you do not watch it.
Wow. Because people who follow football will know sort of the Japanese fans are famous after World Cup matches of picking up litter in the stadium in the area where they've been seated. And I really like the idea that at the litter picking World Cup, they have 90 minutes of picking up litter, and then in the stands, the Japanese fans play football.
I tell you what, you're right, Tom. I thought that they trashed the place and had to pick it up. No, each team, there's three players, they're awarded points based on the amount and type of rubbish they pick up over two sessions at a designated area. A player from Team USA, Beatrice Hernandez, said, sometimes it was really hard because there wasn't really that much trash.
Yeah.
Then we have to look a little bit deeper in the bushes or just really focus on cigarette butts on the floor.
Top tips.
top tips from the pros.
And was it by the item of rubbish rather than like mass of the rubbish? Because if someone finds a discarded, you know, television or something, that's
oh, I haven't thought that. Well, oh God, that'd be great. That's like a bonus item.
Yeah,
well,
that's the golden snitch. Yeah. Yeah.
It's like supermarket sweep where you get the
yes,
get the bonus item. Sweep. Yeah.
Well, yeah. Well, we were the winners with 57.27 kilograms of rubbish. So yeah, wow. Do you know what? We brought it home, Lance.
Absolutely, at last. Home.
We hope that medal was made from recycled materials.
Yeah. So before we go, Tom, where can our friends, where can our listeners find you, and what can they find you doing when they get there?
I post daily Instagram, TikTok videos on Tom Toll, TOAL Comedy. At Tom Toll Comedy.
Okay. Beautiful stuff. And we are all off to our local Hermes delivery hub to see whether they will do us a discount on five children for the price of four. Until next time, goodbye.
Bye.